The plan is very well articulated. Tell us what we should monitor as the biggest risks of execution, both from a corporate point of view, and if any of the divisional people want to talk about the things they have to be particularly vigilant about to make sure that the plan gets executed well.
I'll give it a try. Well, I think Cliff, the biggest indication of progress, I mean, we stressed that the supply chain was one of the biggest single initiatives we're doing, so I think to the extent we can monitor the rollout of the plants, that's a good indicator. The rollout of the plant construction, so that would be a good indicator to watch. What was the second part?
What I'm trying to get at is, what are the things that could go wrong in supply chain to which that you'll have to be vigilant about?
Well, it's the execution of the plans. I mean, I don't know as much else that I can think of, Cliff. Stuff gets launched, stuff gets all the raw material that comes to that plant. All the project planning has to go to plan. And in particular, I think we mentioned one time previously that many of these plant rollouts are relatively simple compared to some of the ones we've done. The one that we really have got to be very careful with is the D11. It's a big optical, multi-layer optical film rollout that will be one really to watch. The others, I don't think the others have any real chance to impact us significantly in any material way.
Dean.
Thank you. It's Dean Dray from Goldman Sachs, and a question for George. Interesting, you started off the day as talking about driving growth, and the very first initiative was rebuilding R&D. And I'd like to hear what exactly you're trying to recapture regarding the capabilities and resources of the R&D capability of 3M of old, or are you trying to get a next-generation R&D capability? Is it just adding more people and, as you have said, wheelbarrows of dollars? Or are you adding people, resources, different locations, geographically, and so forth?
What we're doing is several things, really. We've gotten behind in some technologies. With some markets, we were losing share. Some of the technologies have gotten a little old. We hadn't introduced new products for a while. In one case, we'd even shut down all of our adhesives research. And if you see how important adhesives research is to the company, how many components that we have, how many products we have where adhesive is a complete important component, then you can see that was a real sort of potential tripwire for us. So it's about getting the stuff that had gotten behind, Dean. It was about reopening some of the labs that really should not have been closed. It's about, in some cases, in some platform products that were in need of reinvention, doing those. It was about the attitudes of the people, too, because in the end, you know, people were a little frustrated with our former approach, and winning back the hearts and minds of those people, trying to order the groups in such a way that we identified key skills to apply to these new markets that we're interested in. And then just reminding people, constantly reminding people, this wasn't an exercise in vocational hobbying. We need something to come out the other end of the pipe. And just relentlessly emphasizing that and getting engaged with Fred, particularly Fred and myself. Fred, you want to add in?
Yeah, Fred Blinsley, CTO. A lot of it was really recapturing the old formula of the past, putting R&D front and center. And really, you saw it in some of the slides George talked about, is putting the primary role of the laboratories, new products, and commercializing new technology. The tone from the top has made a big difference. We're rebuilding core technologies. You're going to see four of those key platforms that are being rebuilt and revitalized in the innovation tour that you go through. And it's really recapturing a lot of the old spirit. And you saw it in each one of the – it's been a while since new products, technology, and R&D was front and center in each one of the business plans. And you saw that in the two plans presented today, and it's in each of the six plans as well as the international operations. Also, globalizing R&D, we now have 3,000 people in R&D outside of the U.S. The 34 labs and 25 tech centers that Inga talked about are, again, being put front and center, being staffed and resourced. And so it's all of those pieces that George talks about, but it's really just up front getting the labs back to the business of new products rather than maintaining and defending the existing business.
Next question. Babu? Babu, could you state your name and firm, please?
I
need you to use the microphone.
It's pushed.
You may need to get just a little bit closer to it.
I'll hold it down. Put it closer to it.
So you are increasing capital expenditure and R&D. It sounds to me like your scientists are energized, inspired, and content to some extent. You also go on to say in one of your charts that speed of response is the most important key to success or something like that. Can you explain how you manage to balance those two and perhaps give a concrete example as to how you're doing it?
Well, speed of response is really, again, getting the technical people not only in the laboratories but also out into the marketplace to match the technology platforms to the market needs. You saw some great examples in Jean LeBay's presentation in terms of the mining market. We have technical people literally in the mines. It's really the old 3M formula, getting the people who know the technologies, who know the products, and getting them out into the marketplace to provide solutions. This center is another example. Thousands of customers, including end-user customers, consumer customers, engineers, are coming through this center and being exposed to 3M's 45 technology platforms and their senior scientists. We match up those scientists with the people who are asking for problems to be solved. And that's done, again, through those tech centers around the world. So it's really getting the technical capabilities connected back with the marketplace.
Jeff?
Thank you. Jeff Sprague from Citigroup. A couple times in the presentation, this notion of the market as pyramid kind of came into play, and I think we can all understand kind of pushing down and protecting that flank. What's a little less clear to me from kind of a business model standpoint is how that all ties together in terms of the larger revenue opportunity by going down market versus the margin risk and mix associated with going down market. So I wonder if conceptually if you could give us a little bit more color on how that works. But then specifically on the mother of all pyramids as it relates to 3M, optical films, deciding to go down from the top down into the diffuser market and really what that might portray for your margins going forward.
I guess, Jeff, let me start with this. If you go back to last year's presentation, one of the things that we tried to make perfectly clear is we had to continue to perform at the in our traditional markets at kind of the, I'll call it the top half of it. We had to grow there 5 to 8% at the kind of leverage that we've experienced. So, and that has not changed. We cannot lose that piece of the model, otherwise it starts to fall apart. We have to think of these other businesses really as being expansions to our growth rate. But importantly, as George laid out, there's a lot of opportunity down there that we can go after as long as we're doing the top well. But you can't mix those two and get the price-value equation wrong. In the case of optical film, what's very clear to us is we own the top, but we surely don't own the bottom of that market. And we're going to have to become more aggressive at the bottom part of that market where a lot of the growth is going to come from. And our focus is going to have to be to get the right product at the right price down there to compete without losing our, you know, the top of the pyramid.
All of those elements of the market, Jeff, that you can see that they're elastically connected in price. You can't have this thing doing something at the bottom and it doesn't affect the top. They're all connected in a sort of elastic medium. If you pull down on the bottom, they pull down in the middle and pull down on the top. The only way you can really compete really effectively in those markets, yes, you get some price premium because of the performance in some of these absolutely vital handheld units that need that kind of capability. But it's got to be an integrated thought about the market. And the worst thing you can usually do is to take a really high-performing product at the top and just move it down and just get it wrong. There's got to be proper stratification of the pricing and the value right across the marketplace. That's absolutely vital.
Next question. Herb?
With 75,000 employees approximately in the company, how do you inspire, motivate, get productivity out of not you gentlemen who are doing the main thinking of direction for the company, but how do you spread that to enhance the growth of the company to get it all the way down to the lowest level employee? What do you have in terms of incentive programs, stock ownership, et cetera, that motivates?
Maybe coming first to the energizing part in terms of engagement and so forth. There is, first of all, I think one important thing is that it's clearly communicated the overall corporate objectives. And as you saw when we laid out the four cornerstones of the international organization, it's very important all people are connected into those, understand what is expected of the people, and drive them the whole way through. The way that is communicated is by all of us traveling a lot. We are traveling a lot around the world, and at every place we're coming, there is employee communication meetings that is cascading down in the organization. In addition to that, myself have both phone conferences and webcasts with the subsidiaries the whole time. So that is how the communication is going down. In terms of the programs, in terms of compensation, et cetera, one of the big things that was changed very early, which I believe is one of the key elements of our success now in West Europe, was just the compensation, which became direct related to performance management and to growth. So that is what we are doing. There is also other programs that we have in the company on different levels in terms of giving restricted stock options, et cetera, in order to motivate them. But in terms of making sure there's alignment around our objectives, that's the work that is done by communicating the whole time. And those trips that I personally do all to all subsidiaries is including huge employee communication meetings. But as you know, it's not something that we only can do ourselves here. We need to cascade it down in the organization. And when you work in a big organization like this, I think it's just to make sure that you have a consistent communication that is very clear, so we are at all places at the same time. And that is why I think the formula that we have working here, in terms of, you saw the growth strategies laid out by George that we all are following, is something that gets alignment all around the world.
Joe, could you add something?
Yeah, sure. I'll give you an example of electronic communications. We have a global webcast every month. We clearly explain what we need to do as a big business that's certainly in alignment with the rest of the corporation, making sure every individual understands exactly what their role is and what their specific deliverables are. Essentially, it's about performance culture, and it's about creating a burning platform. You know, George has got a great saying. He says, you know, we're in a global war, and the winner gets our jobs. And that's pretty motivating off the bat. So it's not just about additional incentive compensation, although we do use that. It's also about getting back to what really jazzes people up, and that's about really focusing on truly market-focused, customer-centric markets, and then thinking about customer backwards within our organization. And just a little bit of success, particularly the new products and the success we've recently had that Fred Plinsky was talking about, is really jazzing up employees. 3M really, really is truly about new products. It's our DNA. We supplement that, of course, with some selective M&A activity. But once we get the new products rolling, and now it's really starting to roll and we've got a strong pipeline, it really jazzes up people. And so you communicate what you want, you get a little bit of success, you create that burning platform, and that really is a motivational tool. And then finally, you supplement with clearly everybody understands it's a performance culture. You have to perform to continue to play, and it's a privilege to play. So
thanks. Good question. Shannon?
Yeah, Shannon O'Callaghan, Lehman Brothers. George, you mentioned the acceleration of the organic growth from 5 to 6%. Curious if that's better or worse than you expected. Areas that surprised you on the upside or the downside, and then looking at the 5 to 8 target going from 6 towards the higher end. What would accelerate from here to get you there?
Well, I was actually pretty pleased with in the short period of time to have moved the organic growth rate by a full percentage point in some tough market conditions. I thought was pretty good. Obviously, it's got to go up. When Pat and I have chatted about this before, we want to continue to make this sort of further movement. There's a reason to believe that as new products come out of the pipeline now, as the growth take holds in the corporation, that might accelerate a little bit. I don't want to make any rash promises, but I think we're on a nice ride there where that ought to continue to improve. And if we can add another a point of growth in another year or year and a half, I think we'll have done quite well. Organic, I'm speaking about.
Next, David.
Thank you. Dave Begley, Deutsche Bank.
You push the button, Dave. Push the button to activate.
I'm sorry. Dave Begley, Deutsche Bank. George, why is the operating margin the right metric of being maintained, i.e., if business is value creating, even with a little margin, it should be captured and taken to the portfolio? So why is the value creation rather than operating margins the optimal metric for 3M?
I don't know that necessarily it is. I think we did a talk last year. We used this relative value of growth is Gordon growth model, and it tells you that growth is a much more important than metric than the margin improvement. So what we didn't want to do, though, Dave, I mean, there are some implicit metrics that clearly you don't want to have go to hell in a handbasket, and operating margin was one of them. So we felt if we could actually get the growth, which is the real value creation, and yet not have the other value creator indicators, return on invested capital, margin, go to hell, then we'd be doing a good job. But I don't think there's a lot of science, Dave, in whether it should be 22.8, 22.4. We just don't want to have either investor or even our attention drawn to that as a, my word, is something going wrong. So if we can hold those in a band that people are comfortable with, that they're familiar with, that have been here historically for some time, and still drive the growth, we felt that was a pretty nice platform to build from. That was our kind of thinking, Dave.
John.
John Inch, Merrill Lynch. I'd like to go back to capital allocation, if I could. I think if you compare what you were saying today vis-a-vis your CapEx outlook versus 18 months ago, right, we've sort of dialed the CapEx spend back. It was, I think, 1.5 to 1.7. Now it's sort of 1.4 to 1.5. And, George, if even some of what you are aspiring for comes true vis-a-vis the turns, the OP improvement, and so forth, you're talking about well in excess of $1 billion of future cash generation. So is one of the inferences here that we should be actually looking for 3M to, because, I mean, you sort of suggested you want to really dial back the share repurchase. I mean, is our acquisitions going to fill the gap? I don't really understand. If the cash is going up, your CapEx is coming down, what sort of offsets it, particularly if share repurchase, just doesn't fill the void? Are we looking for acquisitions to step up, or what's really the what's plugging the gap here?
Well, there really is no hidden message, John, in there. The CapEx move is a relatively small move for 1 year. From what we showed you last year. The reality is, if you look versus last year, we had actually accelerated our share repurchase quite aggressively, okay, in our recent past, which has used up some of the cash. Our working capital performance, though, is worse than we probably showed you last year. Our inventory performance isn't quite up to snuff. So a lot of that obviously is yet to come. So don't read in any more, okay, than it's laid out. And even on the M&A side, there's a number up there that's a range of $1 to $2 billion, which we think is a pretty realistic assessment of the normal routine acquisition flow that we have in the system. That would not deal with anything that is kind of completely out of the ordinary. which if you kind of look at some of Jean's ideas and so forth, there would be some more breakthrough ideas that we'd have to step up at that point in time. But don't read anything more into the model than that was out there.
Next.
Chuck.
Chuck Harris from MSoftware. I guess this would go for either Pat or George. You've discussed the fact that on one hand your capacity constraint and fill rates are not where they need to be in a number of the different businesses. On the other hand, you're also talking to Jeff's point about introducing new products in the down market, you know, that bottom end of the pyramid, which is also more cost competitive as well. With a supply chain that also tends to be extended, therefore making everything higher cost. When can we really see that those more down market products really start to take hold in the overall growth rate, given that right now you have a tough time just taking care of what you've got?
Yeah, Chuck, we're not ideology sort of driven on this sort of thing. Clearly, if the company's out of capacity, we're going to sell in the top of the market. As we add capacity, like we have done in OHS, we have the capacity to attack that middle of the market and leverage those plants. So we're not doing this stupidly that we'd sell preferentially something in the middle of the market when we've got capacity missing in the top. You know, we haven't managed to get that get to that stage yet, Jeff. So it's a question of timing. And so first things first, I'll solve the capacity. Solve the demands in the top of the market, make sure that when we launch further into the bottom of the market that the compensation systems for the sales guy, they're tied, they don't get the same bonus for selling in the middle market, low margin, as they do at the top. We've got that kind of stuff linked, so I don't doubt here and there we'll probably make the odd mistake, Chuck, but in broad terms, it looks like we've got it working okay.
Next. Yes. Yes.
Thank you. Matthew Collin, Thompson, Siegel, and Walmsley. Two sort of subtle questions, one for Pat, one for George. Pat, in your presentation, you sort of talked about the accelerated growth and then kind of being able to make some investments. The classic sort of chicken and the egg question, what do you do first? Do you let the sales come in and then invest some of that upside? Or is it, hey, we got to sort of invest first and then see how the sales come through, which, you know, frankly, could be a little bit more risky if you think about it. And then for George, in your presentation, you talked about the class of 2006 acquisitions going, you know, growing at 14% and the class of 2007 growing at 19%. Is that just, you know, fortunate, or, you know, is there sort of a subtle nuance here that we're going away from, you know, sort of pre-commercialization, sort of outsourced R&D to, all right, let's buy some things that are actually, you know, generating revenue and, you know, kind of taking a little bit of the front-end risk of the acquisitions away. Thank you.
And to answer your first question, your question's spot on. If you go back to the diagram I showed of, you know, productivity and growth over time, it's a trickier model to have to manage. And generally speaking, I would say our mindset is see the growth, see the good ideas before you invest, you know, too rapidly. We ran into a little bit of problem last year in the second quarter. We got spending a little bit ahead of our growth rate. We learned a lesson with that. But it's a delicate balance, because the reality is you don't want to stifle good growth ideas just waiting for, you know, waiting for things to happen. So you do at times have to make some bets ahead of where there's a clear market. But generally speaking, I would say we're more on the conservative side to see, you know, is there a good plan here? You know, how's the economy performing and so forth? Then we'll make the investment. And this is something that we manage day in, month in, quarter in. You know, it's something that you have to keep your eye on. It's not something you just put on autopilot and just let it go. It's something that is a day-to-day management of all the business leaders.
I don't think there's anything significant to be drawn from the 14 versus the 19. I think the more important question is the 14 versus the 7 and the 19 versus the 7. And no, there's absolutely no strategic choice for us to sort of point acquisition resources at those to try to drive growth. We are well aware what we did with Brontës That was pre-sale technology. And we've got several others that we're working on right now, just as a means of sort of turbocharging the technology as well. We're trying to do not only stuff inside, but buy stuff which is relevant outside and bring into the company as a means of sort of supercharging the overall growth. So it's just a pure arithmetic quirk and nothing to be drawn from it.
Next question. Yes, sir.
Paul Christofferson, New Vernon Associates. For two questions. One, what are your, Inga, I guess, what are your plans for growth in Central Europe? I have an interest in that. And for George and Pat, some people are talking more lately now about joint ventures, like they've come up with something clever. But I don't hear 3M talking about joint ventures. Is there a do you have a position on that?
Well, let me take the first one relative to Central East Europe. First of all, we separate out Central East Europe and Middle East in terms of regions probably 2 years ago, and the reason for that was to get more focused leadership around the growth in those two parts of the world. Specifically for Central East Europe, the big growth drivers there is, of course, Poland. And as you remember, when we formed BRIC, we added P to that, which was Poland, because for us, Poland was strategically important due to the fact it's type of the gateway in between West Europe and former East Europe. So it became a very important hub for us in terms of investment we are doing there. And it have built on that as we move ahead. Russia is very important for us. We have had a subsidiary there for many years, and in fact I had the pleasure to be the managing director in there for a couple of years. And we are expanding very dramatically in that part of the world. And then when you go down the whole way down to Turkey, we have a sizable organization already there. So we make investment in terms of both domestic, to capitalize on domestic growth that is coming in Russia, Poland, and Turkey specifically. But you have all other countries coming around the Baltic Sea and also coming into countries close up to Kazakhstan, etc. So what we try to do now is specifically also to capitalize on the automotive industry, which have big shift going into Central East Europe, and that is why it's so important for us to be there. So the investment is clearly in place. We are moving into those three big countries specifically, Russia, Turkey, and Poland, and it's both manufacturing and R&D capabilities in order to serve both the local market, but more specifically for the automotive industry that have a big shift going over there. The domestic market is there, is growing, and that is our plan. And as if you remember on the growth dynamics for our operation, if you look upon Central East Europe there, it's very significant in the growth rate this is coming for the next 5 years. And in fact, Central East Europe and Middle East Africa collectively will, in real terms of growth for the future, be as powerful as West Europe.
Tony, since I made you and Paul fight for the microphone there, why don't you go ahead?
On joint ventures.
Oh, I'm sorry.
On joint ventures, historically we had a lot. HC's got five, we think, left. He just closed one out. The biggest in the company is a joint venture with Sumitomo, which is a $2 billion joint venture. You know, my own feeling on joint ventures, some work well, some don't work so well. It's by no means a new discovery by any manner of means. My own feelings are that a joint venture, no surprises here, has to have somebody in charge. You know, the 50-50 joint ventures don't work too well for me in my experience, and joint ventures should have a formal exit. Joint ventures that are planned for all time, generally speaking, don't work. So they're the kind of way we think about it. Joint ventures, we're not in the least bit against them if they make good sense.
Tony?
Tony Bowes, FAF Advisors. How far do the new plants get you toward achieving this optimal international footprint and optimized supply chain, and also your ability to defend and extend your core business?
I think probably, Tony, this tranche that you know about here gets us somewhere between a third and a half of the way. There's going to have to be another tranche of this yet.
Here. Steve.
Just a question on the guidance for EPS. I'm trying to bridge the gap between what you said in May of 06 and now. Back then, I think you said it was 13% growth for 08 and then accelerating to 2010. Now you're saying double-digit growth. I mean, maybe that's just a nuance, but I'm just wondering, given that you've, you know, pretty handily beaten your initial expectations this year, why the revision in the growth outlook? Maybe we're just talking about a different time frame. Is there something specific there? And then with regards to the margin, I'm just having a little bit of a hard time understanding exactly why this thing is going to be flat over the next few years. You know, your gross margin, you said, is going up. Your G&A is going down. You get 40% incrementals on growth, and your international growth is growing faster than domestic, which should be accretive to the margin. So is this just all, you know, discretionary conservatism, or is there something, you know, to Jeff's question, is there something structural here in the business you're going after that's going to, you know, lower that margin rate?
I don't think there's anything, you shouldn't read anything structural into that. Last year we talked about 12-13 kind of as a longer term, you know, horizon number. As we think about, you know, here and now, a double digit number seems appropriate for us. It's not really changing our expectation. I think what is maybe altering our view, maybe a little bit, at least my view on this, is that the growth has picked up. The opportunities to grow have picked up. We see a number of places that we can reinvest back into getting the growth rate up. So if you go back to that simple model that I had of, you know, how much reinvestment you put back, you know, back into the system, that's, you know, the constant trade-off that we're looking at as to how much you flow back into higher growth rates. And we all believe, and you look at any kind of, you know, model, that getting the growth rate up is going to give us a lot better shareholder return than just keeping the margin going. But the underlying, you know, there's, don't misread that what you took away relative to the underlying capability of improving the margins of the business are there. The getting SG&A leverage is still there. You know, all those are true. To me, it's a great opportunity now for us to have a additional funds for us to plow back into additional growth. It's either R&D programs. It could actually be playing further into the down the triangle, okay, which could be into some lower, you know, lower margin businesses. But I think we now have a lot of flexibility on how to, you know, how to play that game.
Martin.
Martin Sankey, Neuberger Berman. I actually have two questions. One is a follow-up on an earlier question, then I have one of my own. The move to down market and to try to capture more of the available markets implies a different kind of skill in terms of brand management than is that is in a few places at 3M, but certainly not across the entire spectrum of companies. How do you view the skills that you need, and how are you trying to get that into the different places in the company where you might need it?
Mo, why don't you maybe take a crack at that?
You know, I have a basic issue with the pyramid shape that we discussed in this meeting. The pyramid in the consumer businesses of 3M is upside down. What I mean by that is that the biggest part of the pie is at the top, is the premium branded products. Post-it note, Scotch tape, Scotch-Brite. However, we participate in all other segments because, as you well know, right now, there are people that, because of the cost of gasoline, let's say, they have a hard time going to Walmart to shop. We want to have what we call OPP, opening price point products for those people that if they happen to be there and they want an inexpensive product, to buy that too. This is not a number that 3M throws out, but our competitors have accused 3M of having 95% market share of the transparent tape business. That is the top of the pyramid we are talking about. So managing that whole pyramid has been fairly easy for us. In Post-it Note, we have done it. In Post-it category, we have done it. In the Scotch tape category, we have done it. In the scouring product, Scotch-Brite, we have done it. If you go to Lowe's, for instance, you're going to see filters. That is the material that goes into the central heating and air conditioning products. You're going to see filters at $6, and you're going to see filters at $30, and everything else in between. And all of that is made by 3M. We are already participating in that, and we have a pretty good handle on it.
Yeah, my point is you have a pretty good handle of it. How do you, you know, what are the other parts of the company where that skill set may be needed? What are you doing to help them?
Right. Well, those are the type of things that obviously in the company we share that kind of information and knowledge. At 3M, we are very good at sharing information. We have marketing forums, for instance, that our marketing people get together and they discuss the marketing programs and how we do things. We have technical forums that technical directors get together once a month and they discuss that. Sharing information is the easy part at 3M.
Mike, maybe you can comment on the ESS.
Yes, sir. Yeah, we have another example that George briefly shared with you around our traffic safety business. This is a bit of a historical example, but it's a good one, and it also indicates how you can, depends a little bit on the market, you know, dynamics, but in this particular case, TSS products came off patent about 10 years ago. They came under tremendous attack from some very aggressive competitors, much like a lot of the things we're hearing here in other spaces. And they had to make a bold move down to the middle of the pyramid to keep relevant to their customers, because this whole pyramid concept's about segmentation. It really is just about segmenting products. You don't abandon the top when you go to the bottom, and you don't, you know, you have to do it all. So what TSS was able to successfully do was to continue to drive products down, reinvent at the top of the pyramid, and continue to push the lower value, or let's say the older products, into lower value segments, so they didn't compromise the premium side of this. And I think that's the key point that George and Pat both made, and that is we really need to be able to maintain the premium side of that, because Mo's right. From a value standpoint, the pyramid is upside down, and from a unit standpoint, it tends to sit on its base. So we have a lot of good examples of doing this, and sometimes it depends a little bit on the velocity of the market you're dealing with and how fast that market moves.
Brad?
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, if I can just add to that on your question, it's a good one. Is how do you learn and evolve it throughout the organization? And the good news is, I mean, we are just one big learning machine, and so there's a lot of examples that we use to share with our divisions. There's also flow of people between the businesses. So while we have a lot of marketing expertise that exists in consumer, we have consumer employees that move into healthcare and help bring some of that expertise into our business and so forth. So we managed to do a pretty good job of leveraging and learning and using examples to move it forward, particularly for units that don't have experience in going down pyramid. And it's a different strategy, requires different skills, different headset.
Thanks, Brad. And I encourage you tonight, ask everyone about this, because it's a little bit different in each business. So. It is 5:15, and so we're going to end the formal Q&A.